Les colloques du Collège de France.
And so now, let me introduce the next speaker, Professor Hugues de Riedmatten. He's working at ICFO in Barcelona and is the head of the quantum photonic group there. Hugues did his PhD in Geneva in Switzerland, and then he went to California in Caltech from 2004 to 2006, and then came back to Europe in Geneva in 2010, and then become a professor. I don't know, you don't call yourself professors at ICFO, but one of the big boss there. So Hugues contributed to key milestones in quantum memory and quantum repeater technology, including the long-distance quantum teleportation, the demonstration of solid-state quantum memories, quantum repeater links, and using either cold atom and solid-state quantum memories. And if you remember, if you attended the lectures, I presented the Quantum Internet Alliance, and Hugues de Riedmatten, and Riedmatten and his group is one of the key people involved in this development over Europe to develop a quantum internet. And I think we will hear more about this. And so I'm very glad that he accepted to come to France and present his work. Please welcome him.
Well, thanks a lot, Pascal, for the very kind invitation. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be here. I'm going to tell you about our efforts to build a quantum network. And we want to build a quantum network, in particular using some device that we call a quantum memory. And this is, again, going too fast. This is not a good one. This is a good one. You can see here basically an example of the quantum memory that I will talk about. This is a crystal doped with rare earth ions. And you can see here on the left a source of entangled photons that we will use to combine to this quantum memory. But before we enter quantum network, let me maybe start with something that we all know, which is basically the classical network, so the internet that we all use daily. So if you want to transmit information over the internet, this is a very simplified explanation. Basically what we do is that we have a computer where we have information stored, and we digitize now this information into bits. And then we will transform this information into light pulses, basically. So we will use a laser. We will trigger this laser. If we have no laser pulse, this will encode the bit 0. If we have a laser pulse, this will encode the bit number 1. And then we will send that, basically, into an optical fiber to distribute, ideally, over the whole world. And finally, at the other side, we will detect this, and we will encode it again and store it into another computer. So what I want to tell with this is that this capacity to transfer information between different kind of medium, between matter and light in that case, is really something essential to build the internet that we use every day. And we will see that it's actually the same for the quantum internet, except that now, in the classical internet, basically, we use intense pulses of light. So we have this laser pulse, which contain billions of photons, and we send them into an optical fiber, and we store it into some classical devices. So quantum effects play a very little role there. But now, in the quantum world, what we want to use is individual photons, single photons, and we want to store that into typically coherences in atoms, in, for example, single atoms or small ensemble of atoms. And then we want to have, basically, also these interfaces between the two, which will be the key enabling step to really build a quantum network. So just to fix a bit the idea of what we want to do, so basically we want to control quantum coherence in matter and light and their interaction. And the kind of object that we want to control are basically these quantum bits. So coherent superposition of zeros and ones, so it could be the polarization of a photon, for example, or a two-level atom. And these are the entangled quantum bits. So if you have two quantum bits, they can be in this entangled state where you have very strong correlations between them, even if you put them at large distances. So then, basically, we can encode bits in quantum bits with that. So Typically with photons we will have light-based qubits that we will use for communicating over long distance. And with atoms, we can do basically quantum processing, a quantum simulation, or storage of quantum information. So basically in this talk, I will tell you now a bit more about what is quantum network, how we can build this light matter interaction to build a quantum network and something that we call a quantum repeater to distribute entanglement over very long distances. And then I will introduce our system, our quantum memory system, and in particular, the system that I will talk about is based on rare earth-doped solids. And finally, I will tell you a little bit about our recent progress that we did in this towards building a quantum repeater and a quantum network. So let's come back now to the network. Now we are going to the quantum domain. So now basically, we want to have a quantum network. So that's we will have basically quantum nodes, which are this material system where we are able to process and to store quantum information. And we want to distribute then entanglement between these nodes using photons. Typically photons are telecommunication wavelength in optical fiber. So these are the quantum channels that will link these nodes. And this was coined by Jeff Kimball in 2008 as the quantum internet. So basically the idea is to network some kind of quantum devices, which could be computers, quantum computers, could be sensors, or different kind of quantum devices. And if we could do that, if we can distribute entanglement widely over large scales, there are many applications that we could actually do. So first, let me just precise. So a quantum internet will not replace the classical internet, but it will complement it. So you will never watch your favorite Netflix movie on a quantum internet, but you can do things on a quantum internet that you cannot do with a classical internet. For example, you could do really secure communication over very long distances. Then you can connect to a quantum computer in a secure fashion. This is something that we call cloud quantum computing, so that even the quantum computer would not know what you are asking it to compute. And then there are other type of applications where, for example, you could link quantum sensors, for example, quantum clocks, to increase now the efficiency. Or you can also have some application where you can have a better accuracy for using telescopes, if you use telescopes and arrays. And these are known applications. There are actually other applications, but it's actually fair to say that probably there will be, once we are able to do that, there will be new application coming. So after all, when the internet was born, when the first demonstration were done in the end of the 1960s, 1970s, we had no idea about how the internet would be used today. So it's fair to say that probably similar things will happen with a quantum internet. And if you want to know more a little bit about this application, you can have a look at this reference here, where Stephanie Werner, Daniel Kuss, and Ronald Hanson basically make a review of various applications. So now we want, so internet is worldwide, right? So we would like ideally to have a network which is also going to long distance. So let's see how we can now distribute light over this long distance. So in fibers, basically what we want to use is basically photons at telecommunication wavelength, for this wavelength at 1550. The problem is that there is loss in fiber. So fiber are actually an extremely transparent material, but nevertheless, after many kilometers, there are some loss. And this loss is exponential now with distance. So the loss is typically 0.2 dB per kilometer. What does it mean? That after 100 kilometers, you have only 1% of the light which is going through. After 500 kilometers, the transmission is 10 to minus 10, and after 1,000, it's 10 to minus 20. So in classical network, in the internet that we know, this problem is solved basically, because what people do is that they introduce amplifiers. So what happens is that the pulses of light are attenuated over the distance, but then they put amplifiers, telecom amplifiers, and then you regenerate your pulse, and then you continue like this. So typically, These amplifiers are this erbium-doped fiber amplifier. And you have basically one of these every 100 kilometer or every 50 to 100 kilometer in the whole world where the fiber network is. So this is a crucial device to make the internet as we know it today work. However, of course, we cannot do that in quantum physics because there is a theorem known as the no cloning theorem that basically tells us that we cannot amplify a quantum bit. You can amplify it, but it will always add some noise. That is, the fidelity will decrease if you do that. And then you cannot basically distribute entanglement with these amplifiers. So we need to find another solution. But just to give you a little bit of a glimpse of how bad this is, this scaling. So let's imagine that now we have indeed this exponential scaling of the transmission. And we have a single photon source that emits, 10 billions of photons per second. So that's a large number, and we can almost not do it today, but one day we will be able to do it. But now we want to send this photon into an optical fiber, basically. So if we go, for example, from Barcelona to Madrid, this is about 600 kilometers, it would take on the average one click. You have an average on the other side, one click per minute. If you go from Barcelona to Paris, about 1,000 kilometers, you would have an average one click every 300 years, even if you have the best detector that we just heard about in the previous talk. And then let's imagine that you want to go to Copenhagen, then you would take more than the age of the universe to have one click. So why is that? So it's not because the photons are slow or anything, right? It's because they are all lost. And the probability to detect a photon then will be extremely low. So you'd have to repeat many, many times before you detect a photon. So this is not a good strategy, right? So we need to find another solution to do that. So there are basically two ways to solve this problem. The first way is to basically get rid of the optical fibers and to use free space and to go to satellites. And this is something that our Chinese colleague have demonstrated a couple of years ago. They put a source of entangled photon into a satellite, and they distributed now the two photons into different points of Earth, and they could reach a distance of around 1,000 kilometers. But for many other, this is something that we can do, but sometimes we would like to stay on the ground and really to be able to use it 24/7, our network to distribute light, to distribute qubits all the time. And then if we want to stay on the ground, we have to use something that we call quantum repeater. And the basic resources of quantum repeaters is this entangled state that I was telling you about before. So how does the quantum repeater work? So the idea now is to basically split the total distance between your two, what we call Alice and Bob, typically, characters that will distribute entanglement, and you will basically split into several links. And you have here, for example, three links, and then you need to create entanglement independently between each of this link. And this is done typically, we will see an example how this is done later, but this is done by sending photons typically in between the two links. And once you know that the entanglement is created, then you want to store it in something that we call quantum memory. So this is a device that then will be able to store and keep the entanglement in it for some time. And once you know that two neighbors are entangled, then you can do some measurement that we call a Bell state measurement. So it's a joint measurement between these two memories here. And this will basically extend now the entanglement to longer and longer distances. So it's important here actually to understand why we need this quantum memory, this storage. So each entanglement in each of these links is something probabilistic. So you have to first, for example, just because you need to have photons traveling between the two nodes, so there is loss, and so it doesn't work all the time. So you have to work, you have to try many times before you have a success. And so now if you combine one probabilistic event here and one probabilistic event here, and you have to both of them to work at the same time, then this will scale very badly because you will basically have an exponential scaling in the time it will take to really distribute this entanglement. But now if you imagine that you can store this entanglement, so when you have a success, you store the entanglement in the quantum memory and then you can leave it there until the rest of the network is also ready, and then you can do this Bell state measurement and extend it. And this will now enable you to basically beat this exponentially bad scaling, and so you can have a polynomial scaling and you can then make it to distribute entanglement in a reasonable time. So in summary, what we need to do a quantum repeater like this, we need to be able to create entanglement in a heralded fashion. Heralded means that we need to have a signal that tells us now you have an entangled state. We need to store it into a quantum memory, and then we need to distribute and to do the entanglement swapping. All right, so now we understood why the quantum memory is essential here. So let's dig a bit more into how we can build such a quantum memory. So quantum memory, what we want to have is a device that can store a photonic qubit. So you have a photonic qubit here at the input, and you want to store in this device for some time. So you want to write it in. It stays there for some time, and then you want basically to read it out. So you want to push a button so that it is read out and come out here at the output. So here, of course, you in classical physics, you would use a memory, would be, I don't know, USB stick or a hard drive or something. In quantum physics, we cannot do that because what we want is to preserve the quantum coherence of the qubits, and we want to preserve entanglement. And so typically what we will use are basically atoms or atom-like systems, and you want to have something that preserves really the coherence and the entanglement. And there are many important properties, but I will list here three important properties. The first one is the efficiency. So everything that comes in the memory should go out of the memory, ideally. The second one is the fidelity. The output qubit should be as close as possible from the input qubit in terms of the state of the qubit. And the last one is the storage time. You want to store light qubits for as long as possible into your quantum memory. I would add another one that I will talk about later, and it's about multiplexing. We heard about multiplexing this morning. We will see that multiplexing is key, so your memory should also be in principle multiplexed. So there are different ways to do that. The simplest conceptual way would be to use, if you want to store a single photon, would be to use a single atom. So you have your single photon, you shine it on a single atom. The problem if you do that is that you have a very small interaction probability, which scales as basically lambda square over A, where A is the area of your on which you can basically focus your photon. And so this interaction in free space is typically quite small. So one solution to this is we heard about it also this morning in the talk of Serge Haroche, is to enhance now this interaction by putting the atom into a cavity. So you put your atom into a cavity, so and the photon will basically bounce back and forth between these two mirrors, and this will increase now the interaction by typically the number of bounces that you can have between these two mirrors. Mm-hmm. And so this is it's a very nice system. It's a close to ideal system, at least conceptually. It's a little bit complicated to implement in the lab, and only a few groups can do that with actually real single atom. Now there are more solid state systems where this can be done also a bit more in a simpler way. So this is one way to use a cavity. The second way that we can use, and this is what I will talk about more in this talk, is to use now many atoms. So now you have still your single photon, but you will absorb it into an ensemble of atoms. And if you can do that, then it's very easy to absorb light, right? You can see that if I have my laser pointer on my hand, basically there are a lot of atoms there, so I can absorb the light very easily. So let's imagine now that we have atoms in this atomic ensemble, which are something that we call atom in lambda state, where you have optical transition and you have some spin states here. So now, of course, absorbing the photon is not all, right? What we want is to be able to retrieve it as well. And so this is where the difficulty will come. So here, basically, you can have this strong light-matter coupling without needing an optical cavity in principle. And so now, here, the way we will encode the information is a collective superposition of the atom. So you have one atom excited, but this excitation is now delocalized between all of the atoms. And the nice point now is that using this kind of state, this collective atomic excitations, we can basically retrieve the photon in a very efficient way, in a well-defined time, in a well-defined direction as well. And another nice point about using ensembles is that now you have many atoms. So in principle, if you have many atoms, you can also store many photons, and you can have some kind of multiplexing. We will come back to this later. So I'm just coming back to this concept of collective atomic state, because this is really crucial to understand how quantum memory works. So now, let's imagine again that you have your atoms. At the beginning, all the atoms will be in the ground state, so they are all in the state G. Then you come with a single photon, and you will now absorb the photon, but the photon will be absorbed in a quantum mechanical fashion, such that you don't know which atom has absorbed the photon. And then you have to basically to sum over all the possibilities. So it could be the first one that absorbed the photon, it could be the second one, or the J-est one, or it could be the last one also that absorbed this photon. And at the end, you get this state that I just showed before, which is this collective excitation with which you can now basically have a single atom delocalized over all the atoms. And again, using this, you can have some efficient readout. Okay, so what do we need now? What are the requirements if we want to build a quantum network? What are the requirements of the nodes that we need? So one of the requirements, we saw it already, we need to have this efficient interface between matter and light. And ideally, this should be compatible with telecom fiber. At least the photon that interacts somehow with this quantum memory should be a telecommunication wavelength, so that it can be sent over long distance. Then you want also to have indistinguishable photons, because at some point these photons will interact with or interfere with another photon coming from another system, and you want to make sure that you have indistinguishability, such that you can do this Bell state measurement that I was telling you about before. You also want to have long-lived qubit storage. So really, like ideally, you want to keep the qubit alive for very long in this quantum memory. Ideally, you want to have a multi-qubit register, not only one, but many, so that you can, in principle, maybe do gates between them, or you can at least multiplex it. And finally, yeah, it would be nice to be able to make quantum logic between the qubits inside this node. So there are many devices that have been proposed. For example, laser-cooled atomic gases or other crystal, which I will talk about today, but also these are ensemble-based techniques, but also single atom-like systems, like single atoms or single ions, or color centers in diamond, or single rare earth ions, for example. So today, all of these systems are studied in this Quantum Internet Alliance European initiative that aims at building a quantum network. So today, I will speak about this one here. So let's see how it works to have a quantum memory now in this rare earth dope solids. So the rare earths are basically this list of elements here. So the ones that are highlighted are the ones that are used typically for quantum information purpose. So we will use typically praseodymium. And these are a very nice system because they provide a large number of atoms with optical and spin transitions, and they are naturally trapped in a solid. You don't need to trap them using other lasers, for example. You can use just one laser to address them. They have excellent coherence properties if you cool them down to around 4 Kelvin, so they need to be in a cryostat. But they have really excellent coherence properties, so people, I will show a slide later, where people have been able to store light for several minutes or even an hour in that system. We are in a solid, so basically what we have is that each ion is a slightly different environment, and so we have a inhomogeneous broadening. Usually it's a bad thing. We will see that actually for us it's a good thing, because it enables us to make time and frequency multiplexing in our system. Finally, we are in a solid, and so with this we can also actually do integrated design. We can do quantum memories in waveguides, for example. And last but not least, these ions have a permanent dipole moment. So in principle, if you are able to isolate and to manipulate a single ion, you have two single ions close enough, you can make an interference, an interaction between them, and you can create a gate. Okay, so now we have a material. Now we need to see how we can store light into this system. So if we just send a photon in, because we have this inhomogeneous broadening, what will basically happen is that the different ions at different frequency will start to dephase between each other, and what we will see is that we will basically lose this coherent superposition of the collective excitation here. And so the light will now be remitted in all directions. On the other hand, now let's imagine that we are able to create this kind of structure where you have now an absorption of the function of frequency, and you have this sort of comb structure here. Then if you do that, what will happen is that the dipole will also dephase between each other, but there will be a time, because there is this periodic rephasing, there will be a time where they will all be in phase again. And when they are all in phase again, then they will basically re-emit the photon in one particular direction. There will be a collective interference that will re-emit the photon in one particular direction. And so this is what we call the atomic frequency comb, and I will tell a little bit more now in more detail how this works. So again, we have now this two-level system here, and we basically now will absorb our single photon. So we will generate now this atomic frequency comb. We will absorb the photon, and we will start to have dephasing. And after a time, which is now the inverse of the spacing between these teeth here, we will then have a rephasing that will now re-emit the photon into the forward direction. And the reason why we like this protocol is that now if you come with not only with one photon at the input, but with a train of single photon at the input, then you will have basically a train of a single photon at the output. So it is inherently temporally multiplexed. You can see here an example of how it looks like. So this is now the absorption in our crystal as a function of the frequency, in megahertz, the scale is missing. And basically, now if you send a photon whose spectrum looks like this, what you will see is that you will have basically an echo after 2 microseconds, which is the inverse of the spacing between the two teeth now. So these are really experimental data. So far, this is actually just a kind of delay, because you cannot choose when you read out the memory. And this is an important thing to have, because when we want to do this synchronization between several links in your network, You want to be able to read, to know when you read out your memory. And so the way to do that is then basically to go from the excited state to the ground state, and to now go from a collective optical excitation to a collective spin excitation. And then if you do that, then basically you can read it out on demand by sending another laser pulse up here, and it will then go down to your initial state. And now we have access basically to longer storage time, and also to this on-demand readout, which is essential for synchronization purposes. All right, so let's start to do now some experiments. We have most of the ingredients. Our node basically is composed of two things. So we have the quantum memory that I just described, but we also need to have an entanglement source. And the way we do that is actually to by separating now the entanglement creation and the entanglement storage. So we have a source that generates photon pairs, where one photon is now resonant with this quantum memory, and the other photon is at telecommunication wavelength, so we can send it over long distance in optical fibers. So our memory is based on praseodymium-doped yttrium silicate crystals. We have a level structure here. So it's basically the optical transition is in the orange at the 606 nanometer. It's not telecom, but it doesn't matter, because what matters is that this photon here that is sent over long distance is in telecom. And so the other ingredient now, we have the memory, the other ingredient is indeed the source. And at the source, we use a spontaneous parametric down conversion source. However, this kind of source usually emit photons which are extremely broad in frequency, hundreds of gigahertz, while our quantum memory has a bandwidth, acceptance bandwidth of 4 megahertz. So to match it, we need to basically put into this optical cavity such that we can reduce the spectrum and have also photon pairs with line width around 2 megahertz. Okay, so now we have all the ingredients finally. So let's try to do some experiments. So what you observe here are basically the coincidence counts between a telecom photon and a photon which is stored and retrieved from the quantum memory. So the first peak here is if you have basically no quantum memory involved, and here, so this is just basically when you have just the input pulse, and then this is the atomic frequency comb echo, which in that case happens after 7 microseconds. And here it's just a two-level system. So now we send control pulses and we bring it down to the ground state, and so we have these two control pulses to bring it down and back up, and then we have here this echo that we call a spin wave echo because it was stored into the spin, and now we have this collective spin excitation. So this pulse here corresponds to a single photon that has been absorbed, transferred down to the spin state, transferred back up, and then re-emitted finally. Okay, so now in the last 10 minutes or so, I will tell you a little bit about the progress that we have done to progress really towards quantum repeater demonstrations. The first challenge, the first important resource that we need to demonstrate is light-matter entanglement. So we want that the quantum memory is entangled with a photon at telecommunication wavelength. And for us, basically what we will do is basically transfer, we generate entanglement with our source, and we will transfer now this entanglement between the memory, between the photon, with one photon and the quantum memory here. And so we actually could realize now entanglement between a spin wave, a collective spin excitation in the quantum memory and a telecom photon. So for the specialist, this is what we call, a Franson scheme. So this is energy and time type of entanglement. And we could reach a fidelity about 77%, which is not super high, but was sufficient to demonstrate this entanglement. And we could store this entanglement now for a couple of 40 to 50 microseconds or so, This is not long enough, again, so this corresponds mostly to the time that the photon takes to travel 10 kilometers into an optical fiber. But we know what the limitation is. This is actually limited by the fact that these two states here, these two spin states, have some inhomogeneous broadening as well. And we know how to solve this in principle as well. And actually, this has been solved in some other experiments, mostly classical. The people have been able to store light in similar crystal for up to 1 minute. And recently, there was another experiment in China where they have been able to store light actually for 1 hour in a coherent fashion into this kind of system. But this is so far classical, and the challenge now is to go to quantum regime. Actually, there was actually an even longer one without light storage, but they could show that you have a 6 hour coherence time in this type of materials. The first step towards the quantum regime now is was done in this paper here, where they have now a weak coherent state, so it's not a single photon, it's an attenuated laser pulse, but you can still show that the noise is good enough to store a single photon. And recently we have shown at ICFO that we can store now really single photons in that kind of material and do this spin rephasing with single photons. Okay, the next challenge now, and this is to show you that these are not lab, not experiments that are done only in the lab, is to try to see if we can distribute now this entanglement outside of the laboratory. And this is something that we did. So this is a map of the Barcelona area. So ICFO is here, quite close to the sea. And basically we had at ICFO our node, basically a source, a photon pair source, and a quantum memory. And then we send a single photon into an installed fiber that went up to this data center here in the center of Barcelona, and then was coming back onto another fiber and detected here at ICFO as well, using superconducting detectors. And with this, basically, we could demonstrate that the fidelity of the state, so far at least with this type of distances, does not change, does not decrease with the distance. So over 50 kilometers, we had basically the same visibility of interference and fidelity. And so it shows that the photonic qubits does not show sign of the coherence, at least within this distance of 50 kilometers of fiber. As a caveat, I should just say that here the AFC was done only in the excited state, and we didn't have the storage time long enough. The storage time was smaller than the travel time, so the memory was read out before the other photon came back. And I should also mention that there were actually a lot of other demonstrations that have been done also outside the lab, using also different platforms. So there was an experiment with silicon vacancy centers in Diamond in Boston, with NV centers in Diamond in Delft, and also with cold atoms, and also with rare earth in Hefei in China, for example. Okay, so now let's see how we can create entanglement within this this system. So this is the second challenge, how we can now create entanglement. So now we have basically one source, one node. We have two nodes. We have to double these two nodes, basically. And we will pump now these two nodes in a coherent fashion. And so one mode will be stored in the quantum memory, and the other one will be sent into an optical fiber that will be mixed at the center here at this spin splitter. And when we have a click at this spin splitter at the center, we will basically, it will erase the information about the origin of the photon, and we don't know if the photon came from this source and we have a photon stored now into memory A, or if we or if it came from the other source and we have a photon stored in memory B. And so in quantum mechanics, when we have uncertainty, we have basically to add the probability amplitudes, and in fact we have a coherent superposition of having a photon in memory A and a collective excitation memory A and in memory B. So it's kind of delocalized now, single photon excitation in that state. So the state is heralded because we have a click at the center that tells us, okay, now you have you have the entanglement, and it is then stored in the quantum memory. And so it's a single click protocol, so we have only one photon that travels half of the distance, and actually scales quite favorably now with loss. On the other hand, there is a big challenge, that is that this phase here is actually the phase acquired by the photon from the central station to basically the source to the central station. So this is a big interferometer. So if you have large distance, this becomes challenging to do. Very quickly here, I want to give another limitation, is that we want to have heralded entanglement. So in principle, what you have to do is to wait until the photon arrive at the central station to know if you have a click, and then to send back the information to the node before you can try again, because you want to make sure that your entanglement is heralded. However, if you now start to have distance between the two nodes, this becomes a problem, because light is fast, but it's not so fast. And for example, if you have 100 kilometers between your two nodes, the maximum repetition rate over which it will take 500 microseconds for the light to travel, so you can repeat only with 2 kilohertz. And then you have also a lot of loss, and so in the end, the success probability goes down very significantly, and the rates will be extremely low. But now if you have a memory that can store not only one qubit, but many qubits, then you can speed up this by a factor of n, and for example, n more than 1,000 is possible, so then you can really speed up the entanglement generation. So this is an experiment that we did a couple of years ago. We had now two setups in two laboratories separated by 10 meters, and we could basically read out we could generate telecom photons and detect them at the center, and based on this, we had a click that were heralding now the entanglement between these two crystals, with actually a rather large, for this kind of experiment, rather large entanglement heralding rate, about 1.4 kilohertz. And now the heralding is also done by a photon at telecommunication wavelength, so in principle, this is now extendable to longer distances. So here we had basically two important things done, telecom compatibility and the multiplex operation. We missed still the on-demand readout, and this is something that we also did very recently now to have this on-demand readout. It's much more challenging. I will not go into the detail. The reason is that you have much more noise when you go to the spin state and you want to read out your memory, so this adds a bit of noise. And so nevertheless, we could also do that very recently, so we could show that we have coherent superposition of a single collective axiomic excitation delocalized between these two spin waves now, and that we can also basically now have entanglement of on-demand readout memories. How much time do I have?
Minus one.
Okay. So let me then stop here. let me just quickly conclude. So basically, I want to say that the distribution of entanglement over continental distance is actually an enormous experimental challenge. And we have done a lot of progress recently, but we are still very far from being able to do that. We need to progress on all the performances and really try to combine different kind of technologies together. But if we can do that, this will really open new opportunities in several fields, in quantum communication, but also possibly in sensing, possibly in computing. And on the way, there is really fascinating physics, because we really need to learn how to control all of these systems and to really make control the light matter interactions. So let me thanks my team also, and thank you for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.